Scott here with a very short announcement before this episode begins. This episode is part of a series I'm doing about history's most insane rulers because I have a book that just came out and is available now called History's 9 Most Insane Rulers. Looking at the lives and reigns of people like Emperor Caligula, Ivan the Terrible, Kim Jong-il, and some other lesser-known people like Charles VI, who thought he was made of glass, Ottoman Sultan Ibrahim I, who shot arrows at his court subjects and ordered his advisors to find the fattest woman in the empire to join his harem, and former president of Turkmenistan, Akbar Turkmenbashi, who had an 80-foot-tall golden statue made of himself that always rotated to face the sun. The book looks at what it would be like to be under the rule of somebody like this who had almost unlimited power, whether power makes somebody go insane, and if these stories have any warnings for us today. So in each of these episodes, I go over a little of what's in the book, but you can go into way more detail if you check it out. You can find it anywhere where books are sold, Amazon or elsewhere, or if you go to the website mostinsanerulers.com, you'll find a link there, and you'll also find a quiz to determine which insane ruler you are. And if you like the book, if you could please leave a review on Amazon, that'd really help it out. Hope you enjoy this episode. History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hey everyone, welcome back to our series on history's most insane rulers. In the last episode, we kicked things off with a look at the life of Emperor Caligula of Rome. Now we're going to jump ahead into the Middle Ages and look at someone who is a victim of the inbreeding that's going on at the royal levels all across Europe. And because of this, many think that he developed a blood disease called porphyria, leading to his mental illness and his insanity, which caused him to believe that he was made of glass. We're going to look at Charles VI of France, who lived from 1368 to 1422. Overall, I'd say that fate was unkind to Charles VI. Earlier in his life, the king was known as Le Bien Ami, or the Well-Beloved, for his generous character. He cared for the welfare of France's commoners, and even allowed non-aristocrats among his counselors. But France experienced the worst decades in its history during his reign. During his 40 years as king, the Hundred Years' War raged on, and France continually lost battles and land holdings to England. His subjects were killed in massive numbers through war, disease, and civil disorder. He was forced to cede power to the English, and even to members of his family. Charles managed to survive multiple assassination attempts, but many of his advisors weren't so fortunate. France's decades of decline culminated in its disastrous defeat to the English at the Battle of Agincourt in 1415 and the Treaty of Troyes in 1420, which named an English king as the rightful successor to the French throne. Suffering through all this hardship, his sanity finally cracked and broke. He was no longer called Le Bien Ami. After his death, Charles was referred to as Le Fou, the Mad. France had a long history of mentally unstable monarchs, going back arguably to the king's founding in the 5th century. Its first mad king was Clovis II, who ruled from 633 to 657. Medieval monks considered him a do-nothing king, declared him insane, and attributed the stupidity of his descendants to him. The stories are he went mad after stealing the arm of a dead martyr. His great-grandson, Childeric III, who ruled from 717 to 754, was known as the idiot and was even more feeble-minded. He was the last king on the Merovingian line before Pepin the Short, father of Charlemagne, deposed him. By the time Charles VI became king, France and the rest of Europe hit another low point. The 14th century was perhaps the most unstable period in Europe since the Roman Empire collapsed 800 years earlier. The Great Famine of 1315 to 1317 left millions to starve, with countless children abandoned by parents who could no longer support them. Sources claim the starving turned to cannibalism. A few decades later, the Black Plague killed one-third of Europe. In 1360, Giovanni Boccaccio wrote in the Decameron that Europe had fallen into near-apocalyptic conditions. He writes, "Such terror was struck into the hearts of men and women by this calamity that brother abandoned brother. What is worse, and nearly incredible, is that fathers and mothers refused to see and tend their children as if they had not been theirs. Charles was crowned in 1380 at the age of 11 on the heels of this continent-wide chaos. His uncle Philip ruled as regent when he ascended the throne until he fully assumed power in 1388. Charles ran state affairs with the aid of his brother, Louis of Orleans, but the realm was in a poor state. Philip had raised taxes and depleted the treasury to fund war with England. French peasants revolted in response. But despite these challenges, the young king was lucid in the first decade of his reign, and he managed to calm domestic disorder a little bit by curbing nepotism at the royal court. Advisors were traditionally blood relatives, but Charles broke with this precedent by appointing intelligent advisors who were neither princes nor civil servants. He dismissed his uncles, bringing political and economic stability to the French kingdom. This break with the status quo, however, triggered intense competition in his court. Princes of blood, mostly Charles' uncles, vied with this close-knit group of advisors, whom they called the marmosets, or monkeys, a term at time for the English. In another kingdom, Charles could have remained a figurehead king and left the work of governance to a patchwork of lords and landowners. However, France was a centralized state in which the king actively ruled and didn't delegate duties to an aristocratic oligarchy, and if he did, then he could risk being overthrown. The family members continued to vie for power, particularly his brother Louis of Orleans and John the Fearless, Duke of Burgundy. Chaos and conflict engulfed France for the rest of Charles' reign. He died in October 1422, leaving behind a severely weakened kingdom on the verge of catastrophic defeat to the English. The France of Charles VI's early reign was a disaster area. Those who weren't killed by plague or famine fell to irregular soldiers and brigands. During the decades of war with the English, its armies and their mercenary allies sacked towns and plundered the countryside. Unprotected peasants and townsfolks were robbed of harvests and left to starve. Charles' father pursued a policy of reconstruction and retrenchment against future attacks. But France couldn't mount an effective military response to the English because of its squabbling political factions. Despite the turmoil in the background, Charles was coronated in full medieval splendor. Crowned in Reims, he traveled there in the middle of an entourage of princes and knights. He was described as beautiful, a blonde boy with freckles, and tall for his age. He held his place in the cathedral without weakness at the center of a grand troop. The following Sunday, the king made his entry into Paris. Tapestries billowed from the windows. Fountains and wine were set up in the squares, with scenes organized by the city's middle classes. The crowd acclaimed to the child, "Noel, Noel!" Feasts, dances, and jousts followed his entry. But behind the scenes, his uncles were already scheming to expand their land holdings at the expense of the French crown. Before Charles ruled independently, Philip the Bold, the Duke of Burgundy, created a semi-autonomous appanage in the county of Flanders. He had nearly enough territories and power to rival Charles. Louis I, the Duke of Anjou, wanted to acquire the Kingdom of Naples, the homeland of his mother, from whom he inherited a claim to that land. John, Duke of Berry, ruled the province of Languedoc and heavily taxed it to fund the war against the English, leading to a peasants' revolt. Nevertheless, Charles paid no mind to these intrigues during his minority. He sought pleasure in hunting and jousting, taking part in a tournament soon after receiving the holy unction at his coronation. He even rode 9 courses at a tournament held to celebrate the double marriages of the son and daughter of the Duke of Burgundy. A stronger distraction for him came in the form of a Bavarian lady of royal background. Charles was a lusty and energetic young man, as he's described in chronicles, with strong carnal appetites. They surfaced when his uncles introduced him to Isabeau of Bavaria in 1385. She was great-granddaughter to Wittelsbach Holy Roman Emperor Louis IV. They suggested a political marriage to create an alliance with the House of Wittelsbach. The two royals were 16 years old at the time. For the youths, it was love at first sight, and it could have been little else but that, because she didn't speak French and he didn't understand German. But despite the language gulf, Charles was instantly smitten. On their first meeting, Charles felt, quote, happiness and love enter his heart, for he saw that she was beautiful and young, and thus he did greatly desire to gaze at her and possess her. He demanded they be wed immediately, which the two did 3 days later. And if, court historian and royal chronicler Jean Froissart commented, they passed that night together in great delight, one can well believe it. The young couple did spend their early marriage in happiness. They feasted together on several occasions and held lavish festivals that lasted for days. On their first New Year together in 1386, Charles gave her a red velvet saddle, lined with copper and adorned with intertwined K and E, for Carol and Elizabeth, the German rendering of their names, among many other gifts. Charles grew in power as his uncles waned. He took personal rule in 1388, relieved his uncles of their duties, and restored the advisors of his father, the Marmosets. They reorganized the French court, declared the king responsible for leading a new council with honest and capable administrators, including a few non-aristocrats. Their goal was to purge the corrupt court, the royal uncles, and revive the administration of Charles V. But the happy years of his reign soon ended, along with his mental well-being. Charles declined as described in detail by court chronicler and eyewitness Jean Froissart, a historian patronized by aristocrats in England, France, and the Low Countries. Three events occurred in 1392 and 1393 that triggered Charles' madness. The first was a severe fever that occurred during the launch of a military campaign. On Easter Day 1392, the king insisted on an expedition to Brittany despite the objections of his uncles and advisors over his illness. During the king's stay at Mons, he labored hard in the council despite having little help and not being restored to health. One account writes that he had been the whole summer feeble in body and mind, scarcely eating or drinking anything, and almost daily was attacked with fever, to which he was naturally inclined, and this was increased by any contradiction or fatigue. Charles began acting crazed, and some onlookers were shocked. They couldn't explain what had come over the king, who until then had appeared mentally stable. Because his madness came suddenly and unexpectedly, Charles's uncles first ascribed it to bewitchment or poison. The king's physicians announced in response he'd suffered from an unknown disorder due to his weakness of intellect. Others thought that environmental triggers set off the frenzy. Whatever the reason, the king convalesced and was restored to health eventually. The second event that triggered his madness was an attack on his faithful advisor, Olivier de Clisson, constable of France, by Pierre de Craon, a debauched aristocrat. He'd been expelled from the French court. He was a protege of Charles's enemy, John IV, Duke of Brittany. Marked for assassination, the plan was to send men to ambush Clisson en route to his lodgings in Paris after dining with the king at a royal residence. On June 13, 1392, an assailant waylaid him in a narrow Parisian street. He was stabbed, but not fatally, due to his chainmail coat. Clisson staggered into the doorway of a baker's shop and was rescued. Craon thought that Clisson was dead. He fled Paris and made his way to friendly territory in Brittany. When learning that his men failed in the assassination, he told the Duke, "It is diabolic. I believe that all the devils of hell to whom the constable belongs guarded and delivered him out of my hands, for he suffered more than 60 blows by swords of knives, and I truly believed him dead." Charles was outraged when he heard the news. He unleashed his fury on all who aided the attempted murder of his constable. He had executed his stewards, two squires, and a page. Charles then sought swift revenge. He planned an expedition to Brittany while still suffering bouts of fever and incoherence. In the course of his journey, the chronicler of St. Denis, who was with the king, reported that he spoke nonsense and made rude gesticulations. Charles suffered from, quote, "a strange and hitherto unheard of disease," which the king was doubled over with high fever and lost his hair and nails. The symptoms suggest typhoid or cerebral malaria or encephalitis, but we're not exactly sure. Charles returned to Paris to convalesce and prepare again to lead his army against the Breton Duke, but his royal physician opposed the expedition. His doctors suspected Charles suffered from the same mental illness as his mother Joanna of Bourbon, who experienced a complete nervous breakdown after the birth of her seventh child in 1373. The king spent a month recuperating and eventually recovered. Froissart thought that the rising of heated humors to the brain of Charles created a pathology. The diagnosis has a hint of truth, as a heat stroke or an attack of hypothermia could have damaged his brain. Other historians have suggested schizophrenia. Charles had a predisposition to mental illness from his mother's side, and this incident was merely one of the many schizophrenic episodes that occurred throughout his life. Other contemporaries thought the king's madness had a supernatural origin. The monk of St. Denis believed that the king was triggered by a mad prophecy that caused him to fall into a state of psychosis. On August 5, 1392, a scorching summer's day, the king approached the borders of Brittany. He had consumed a considerable amount of wine and wore a black velvet jacket, a cuirass, which was an armor breastplate and backplate fastened together, and a hat of scarlet velvet. He and his company went forth on dusty tracks. They traveled through the forest near Le Mans in the morning. By midday, the king left the forest and entered a sand plain where the sun was striking heavily. Everyone suffered from the heat. The princes trailed behind the king to minimize the dust and not dirty his garb. The expedition then approached the forest and neared a leper colony. One leper stepped from behind a tree, dressed in a raggedy white smock, and appeared to be raving. The leper rushed up to the retinue and seized the bridle of Charles's horse. The men-at-arms forced him away from Charles and set him on his way. Any other French subject would have likely been arrested or struck down for such reckless actions toward the king, but they thought him to be a madman and released him. However, the leper was unfinished. He followed the king and cried out, "Ride no further, noble king. Turn back. You are betrayed." An escort beat the leper back, but again didn't arrest him. He continued to follow the procession for an hour with his cries. As he returned eventually to the leper colony, his voice cried betrayal and echoed from the forest. And naturally, this disturbed Charles. When the group left the forest, one of the king's pages, who was half asleep from the heat, dropped the king's lance. It clattered on the steel helmet of his companion and startled the king. Charles catched a glimmer of light as the sun reflected off the lance and spurred his horse and drew his sword. He cried out, "Attack! Attack the traitors! They want to deliver me!" He tried to run his sword through the Duke of Orleans. The Duke escaped, but Charles killed four in the ensuing scuffle before his officers restrained him. One of those killed was a knight of Gascony. The Duke of Burgundy exclaimed, "The king is out of his mind. Hold him, someone!" The Lord of Bacqueville finally managed to seize the king from behind. Others grabbed his broken sword from the scuffle. Disarmed, Charles was pulled from his horse and gently laid on the ground, prostrate and speechless. His eyes rolled strangely in his head. The king recognized nobody and said nothing. Charles then fell unconscious, his body becoming cold, and his pulse weakened. He lost all sensation in his limbs. His attendants placed him in an ox cart and returned him to Le Mans. The king couldn't speak for 2 days, and after regaining consciousness, was unable to recognize anyone, including his uncles and brother. Some thought his illness was God's punishment for heavy taxes or insufficient support of the church. Others thought sorcery had been at work. During the king's convalescence, the royals made a power play and reclaimed their role as advisors. They marginalized the marmosets for a time, but the two continued to struggle throughout Charles VI's reign. Charles regained his sanity for 4 months, but then experienced a third event triggering his complete fall into madness. It was by far the most frightening in his life. On January 28, 1393, Isabeau arranged one of her ladies-in-waiting to marry a prominent gentleman. Held in her honor was a costume party, later known as the Ball of the Burning Men. The celebrations included a masquerade, which induced 5 young noblemen to appear as near-naked savages, which an account notes, such was the indelicacy of the times. The king decided to join his friends in the incognito group. Their dress was made of linen cloth, soaked in tar to appear shaggy from head to foot, and designed to sit close to their bodies. The costumes were highly flammable, which was a big risk in a palace illuminated with torches. No one could guess the identity of the wearers. At one point in the ball, the Duke of Orleans arrived with friends. He feigned running a lighted torch against one of the savages. But the fire came too close and ignited the costume's materials. Flames erupted, which quickly spread to the rest of the group. The party fell into chaos. Isabeau and the Duchess of Berry were the only two who were aware that the king was in one of the costumes that had just been set on fire. During their torments, the costume men called out, "Save the king! Save the king!" The queen fainted. The Duchess saved Charles's life by wrapping her robes around him to extinguish the flames. Another member of the group leapt into a cistern of water. The four others weren't so lucky. Terribly burned, they succumbed to their injuries over the next 2 days. A frightened Charles suffered a complete mental breakdown. Later, the king was so overcome by grief that he flew into a rage at anyone who tried to help him. When physicians came to treat him and deliver his food, Charles would claw and bite those who entered his private apartment. He denied that he was king and couldn't recognize Queen Isabeau. Charles declared that he wasn't married and never had children. He even destroyed objects displaying the fleur-de-lis, the symbol of the French monarchy. The king could be lucid for brief intervals, but his general madness continued for 6 months. Charles only appeared to recover, according to his own reckoning, after making a pilgrimage to Mont-Saint-Michel. As I mentioned at the start of this episode, there was a long lineage of madness in the line of the French kings, And part of the explanation could also be due to the centuries of intermarriage among European royal houses. Kingdoms paired their children with one another as stratagems to inherit territories. England and France demanded each other's land in the Hundred Years' War, partly because their royal lines intertwined to the point that the English could rightfully claim the crown of France. This intertangled circumstance of familial lines and family conflict that turned into warfare wasn't unique to the English and French rivalry. All European royal dynastic lines had equally intermingled by this point. The result of this was family struggles amongst kingdoms, but also genetic defects, hereditary diseases, and madness on a lot of thrones. Mental illness came from Charles's mother, Joanna of Bourbon, and passed through him to his daughter, Catherine of Valois. The Bourbon dynasty also suffered from mental infirmities. Joanna's brother, Louis II of Bourbon, suffered from acute depression. The English line was similarly affected when King Henry V married Catherine to conquer France as part of his growing kingdom. Unknowingly, he opened the door for hereditary diseases to affect his bloodline as well. Charles had a total of 44 psychotic episodes throughout his reign. These lasted up to 9 months in duration, followed by short spells of clarity. Between psychotic episodes, Charles was mentally healthy and capable of leadership, and he was able to pick up his royal duties again. Only one chronicler, who wrote his history after the death of Charles, suggested that the king's mental health had degenerated over the years and he never really recovered. But even this chronicler, named Monstrelet, acknowledges the king appeared to return to health after his first breakdown. Nevertheless, by the grace of God, he recovered his health, and has since, although not as soundly as he possessed them before this accident. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. Over time, the periods between recovery and relapse shortened. Hope for Charles's full recovery declined along with his health. Even during times of clarity, his memory was weak. In later years, he was unable to take part in decision-making, other than casting the deciding vote for imperial matters between his uncles and brother, Louis of Orléans. During bouts of madness, he couldn't govern responsibly or even keep up the facade of leadership. Opportunists took advantage of the king's condition. During a manic episode in 1395, Charles treated those close to him with suspicion and distrust, particularly his physician, Renald Freron, whom he exiled from Paris, along with 22 doctors, 2 surgeons, and an apothecary. Charlatans came to the court, claiming the power to heal the king through magic. One was named Gérard de Barre, a so-called physician accused of practicing sorcery in 1398, for which he was executed in Paris. In his formal confession, he acknowledged invoking demons, devil worship, and consecrating swords, steel mirrors, and rings to summon dark spirits. He also created necromantic images of Charles and the Duke of Burgundy, trying to gain power over them. By 1396, Charles exhibited the full signs of what some believed to be chronic schizophrenia, which in its more acute form caused hallucinations and even acts of violence. Sometimes he was listless and prostrate. Other times he was excitable and ran to the point of exhaustion, claiming to be chased by enemies. Accounts further record him damaging royal property. In late 1397, Charles asked that all knives be taken away from him and his courtiers. In another episode, he feared himself bewitched and begged that those who had enchanted him let him die. In 1405, another fit of frenzy that lasted for 6 months caused the king to display himself in a filthy state. He neglected his hygiene and refused to have his bed linen changed. He had hallucinations and thought himself breakable, and that 1,000 lead needles were pricking him. Charles tore his clothing, threw the apparel in the fire, and urinated on his outer garment. He refused to change his linens for a month, bathe, or shave, and was affected by lice. The court physicians decided the king could only be cured by shock treatment, and this means shock in the sense of surprise, not electrical stimulus, which basically would have been impossible to generate at that time. In November, a group of 10 men with blackened faces entered the royal apartment to frighten him. Surprisingly, this method worked, and Charles agreed to be cleaned. The most well-known case of Charles's insanity involves bouts of the glass delusion. This psychiatric disorder causes sufferers to believe themselves to be made of glass and susceptible to shattering into pieces at any moment. The king refused to allow others to touch him and required them to don protective clothing to prevent himself from fragmentizing. To keep a completely serene environment, it required all the windows in his palace to remain shut. Anyone who approached him had to do so on tiptoe. Future Pope Pius II claimed Charles inserted rods into his clothes for added protection from a deadly fall. But Terry Peitakainen writes in the book Madness of History that the glass delusion was a subset of melancholy. Sufferers feared that exposure to others, or even to the sun, could cause them to break. Some believed themselves to be oil lamps or chamber pots or some other object made of glass. Others thought themselves imprisoned in a glass bottle. Medieval and Renaissance physicians saw this illness in other patients, notably noblemen and scholars, and wrote accounts of it, which became associated with a more well-known affliction called scholar's melancholy. 16th century Dutch physician Levinus Lemnius chronicled cases of this disorder. He had a patient who refused to sit, fearing that his glass rear end would break. To accommodate his fragile hindquarters, he stood while defecating. These glass people, as they were called, could also believe they were chamber pots. The fixation with urine for people who suffered this disorder could have come from the Greek theory of the four humors, in which the dark color of urine was associated with melancholy, maybe meaning that they were psychologically conditioned to accept a prognosis that made sense with the medical knowledge of their medieval society. Miguel de Cervantes, author of Don Quixote, probably knew of these accounts when he wrote a short story, The Glass Graduate, in 1613. It was the story of a madman who thinks that he's made of glass. He fears physical contact and only drinks out of his cupped hands. So why did Charles and other nobles and scholars believe they were made of glass? The disorder is mostly non-existent today. It disappeared a few centuries after Charles's reign. If the glass delusion does still exist, it's not widely known, and the few modern examples we have are 20th century pianist Vladimir Horowitz and Glenn Gould, who both feared their fingers would be damaged. But Terry Bakanian speculates that the delusion came from confusing a metaphor about physical and spiritual health with a statement of fact. Medieval Europeans were preoccupied with the union of the body and the soul. Their theory of medicine dictated that the vital life forces were contained in their fragile vessels, their bodies. The theology of the time borrowed this imagery, in which sinfulness was associated with a broken vessel, while glass was associated with cleanliness and purity. So the glass delusion could be seen as an overlap between beliefs and values, and the afflicted took literally the metaphor of glass as a container for your pure bodies and souls. Well, whatever the nature of his disorder, the legacy of Charles VI lives on in literature and film that followed his descent into insanity. Notable examples include The Night of Queen Isabeau, a 1920 German silent film, and The Notebooks of Malte Lorenz-Brigg, an early 20th century German novel by Rainer Maria Rilke that influenced French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. Charles's larger legacy was genetic. He directly afflicted the neighboring realms of Europe after his death, by possibly spreading his mental illness to the rulers of those kingdoms through intermingled bloodlines. Due to the same policies of royal intermarriage that brought madness to Charles, he passed on mental illness to his grandson, Henry VI of England. Henry's own battle with insanity and inability to govern England led to the dynastic struggles of the Wars of the Roses. Beyond Charles's genetic influence on Europe's future monarchs, the king's fits of madness disrupted his kingdom, sent it into turmoil, and weakened France to the point of its disastrous defeat in the Battle of Agincourt in 1415, and its near total defeat in the Hundred Years' War. England controlled much of northern France from 1420 to 1435. Henry VI was crowned King of Paris in 1431. The English remained in Normandy until 1450. France's subjects suffered from Charles' inability to enforce justice. The worst power struggles were between Louis I, Duke of Orleans, and John the Fearless, Duke of Burgundy. In 1407, John kidnapped Charles's eldest son, the heir to the throne. The queen later recovered him. At this time, Louis I effectively governed France and was rumored to be the queen's lover. Not only that, he also tried to seduce the Duke of Burgundy's wife. She refused Louis, so he tried then to rape her. The Duke of Burgundy decided to be rid of Louis. On November 23, 1407, Louis rode back from Isabeau's house in Paris with 10 guards in his retinue. Suddenly, 7 or 8 masked armed men rushed the guards, shouting, "Kill him! Kill him!" They cut off one of his hands and sliced his head in two. The Duke of Orleans lay battered to death in the street. Suspicion for the murder quickly fell on the Duke of Burgundy, who ended all doubt by admitting he ordered the murder. He issued a justification in 1408 that he ordered the killing for the general good of the realm as an act of tyrannicide. He said that Louis had oppressed the people of Orleans through excessive taxation and prevented reform. He even accused Louis of trying to bring about Charles's death by black magic. John the Fearless fled Paris shortly after the assassination, not out of fear of Charles, but for the safety of his own territory. The king, in fact, accepted the justification and issued a formal pardon. A ceremony of reconciliation between the Duke of Burgundy and Louis's son was held in Chartres Cathedral. The assassination of the king's brother demoralized the French government. Moreover, the knowledge that there was considerable public support for the duke's deed prolonged and deepened the court's inaction. Charles's response to the assassination, and the failure to punish John as his henchman, was considered inadequate. The faction allied with Louis resented that justice was underserved. The event triggered more warfare and widened the rift between supporters of the two dukes. Violence between the factions grew as they restlessly sought revenge. Chroniclers no longer looked at Charles as a well-intentioned king sabotaged by his own poor mental health. They considered him a tyrant plunging the kingdom into civil war. According to the Westminster Chronicle, Charles played the despot over his people more savagely than he had ever done in the past. According to a report, or rather according to true and established fact, other advisors and officials thought that he was more powerless than tyrannical. They thought of invoking the church law tenet of Rex Inutilis, or useless king. The tenet originally applied to bishops who were unable to perform their duties, but by the 13th century, this theory was applied to incompetent lay rulers. Kings were deposed under this tenet, including Sancho II of Portugal in the 1200s, who let his kingdom fall to ruin due to his idleness, timidity of spirit, and simplicity, as he was described. France's neighbors took advantage of the chaos. What followed was the greatest military disaster in medieval French history. In 1415, English King Henry V landed near the Norman seaport of Harfleur with 30,000 men. He captured it after a five-week siege. France countered with 50,000 troops led by Constable Charles d'Albert. He destroyed the fatigued English force. Henry offered to surrender his conquest of Harfleur for a safe passage to Calais. This offer was rejected by the French, so Henry determined to force his way through. Half of his exhausted force returned to England, leaving him only 15,000 men. The French force consisted of 60,000, headed by the Dauphin, or Charles VI's son, and all princes of royal blood. The resulting conflict was the Battle of Agincourt, the most significant English and French battle of the 15th century. English longbowmen famously mowed down French forces, especially its cavalry, which were impeded by the clay ground softened by the rain. Few victories are ever more complete than this. The English lost as few as 100 men. The French lost Constable Louis d'Albert and 7 princes. Over 10,000 French died, and many just left on the battlefield. France's losses in battle and its internal turmoil incited Paris to revolt. The Duke of Burgundy captured the city in 1418 and stoked this anger, leading Parisians to force open the city's prisons, murdering the jailers and guards, making the prisoners walk out one by one, and massacre them all without distinction of age or gender. Some prisoners ascended the tower to repel the mob, which led to the strange sight of prisoners keeping a siege. They couldn't hold back the mob, which forced the prisoners to throw themselves from the towers onto the pike-filled streets below. One account claims the mob stood up to their ankles in human blood. In the end, the English pressured Queen Isabeau to persuade Charles to sign the disastrous Treaty of Troyes in 1420. Under the terms, Charles disinherited his offspring and named the King of England as successor to the French throne. The treaty arranged for the marriage of Charles's daughter, Catherine of Valois, to Henry V, who became regent of France and heir to the French throne. The Dauphin, Charles VII, was for a time disinherited from succession, along with his offspring. Isabeau agreed to oust her son in the hope of ending the war with England and return France to prosperity under the rule of a capable king. Overall, Charles's story of madness stands out in the historical record because of the impact that his poor mental health had on the lives of thousands of French subjects. At his death in 1422, independent France was whittled down to its heartland of Orleans and cities along the Loire River. Paris itself lay deep in English territory. Charles VII established a makeshift court at Chinon. The French were without hope until a young maiden from Orleans named Joan arrived at the court and made the incredible claim of being sent by God to liberate France. Her story is well told elsewhere, But the miraculous rescue of France by a 17-year-old peasant girl, Joan of Arc, wouldn't have been necessary if it hadn't been led by an insane ruler, Charles VI. All right, well, that's all for this episode. In the next episode in our series on insane rulers, we're going to be looking at the reign of the Ottoman Sultan Ibrahim I, who loved to practice archery on his court subjects, and he also commissioned his advisors to search throughout the empire and find the heaviest woman he possibly could to enter his harem, which they did. There you have it. That is all for today's episode. I'd like to kick things off by thanking the Spy Masters for this episode, and I'll explain what that is in a second. Vic Austin, Chris, Rob Matlock, Alan Baker, Beverly Ingle, Jake Harrington, Todd Warren, William Ivey, Michael, Chester, Melissa, Tyler from Colorado, Josh Reddick, Daniel Lawson, Moondoggy from Ohio, David Powell, William Ivey, Josh Reddick, Tim Clark, Tim Powell, Carl from Norway, Tom from Ohio, Chris C., Nick Brooks, Jennifer French Lee, and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on Earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.